from deep inside your radio.
From London, England, ladies and gentlemen, literally from Hammersmith. Literally flyover country, because there is a freeway over, what we call a freeway overpass. They call a flyover that goes over Hammersmith. And this is the first time I've ever been in Hammersmith and have not flown over it. So that's a treat. It's so gray and gloomy here. It's instant winter. And that's just the weather. Then there's the economic outlook. Going around London this week, I couldn't help thinking to myself, ooh, which of these stores is going to be open after Christmas? This is, might be the last shopping trip for him. And what about her? And gloomy as the weather is, it's not traditional gloomy London weather, even though it looks like it. According to the Times of London, these are the remnants of Tropical Storm Laura, which went up off the eastern coast of North America, of the United States specifically. It was expected to run out of steam over the North Atlantic, but it unexpectedly found a new lease on life off the coast of Newfoundland and then bounced across the Atlantic to come here. Who would be stupid enough to live someplace where hurricanes can happen? That's what I want to know. The bailout, lady. Oh, first, who would have... Did you hear anybody critical of the jury in the new O.J. trial for only deliberating for 13 hours? Now, I know that's a lot more than three, but the jury in the new O.J. trial just deliberated for 13 hours. I think that's because the residual joy of just seeing the guy perp walked away, wiped away any vestigial anger at the short time a jury might be considering his fate. I don't know. Maybe there's another reason. How about that bailout, ladies and gentlemen? I don't know still how I feel about it after all this, except there is this. The finance, insurance, and real estate sectors of the economy contributed twice as much money to senators who supported the bailout as those who opposed the legislation. This according to the Center for Responsive Politics. The center found the gap between lawmakers voting yes on the ballot and those voting nay, was especially wide among Senate Democrats. Those who supported it had collected 51% more from the financial sector than those who voted against it. Senators who supported the bailout have received an average of $3.9 million from the finance sector since 1989, 139% more than the opponents of the bailout, who've only received $1.6 million. In the current election cycle alone, the difference is even greater, 379%. Okay, maybe that clears it up. And, ladies and gentlemen, I was at a BBC facility this week where they had just unearthed from the archives the script that was written, I believe, in 1974, that was supposed to be written by a distinguished BBC newsreader, a trusted voice, you see, and to be played in the event of a nuclear attack. I think this makes a nice bookend to that warning we had a few weeks ago about, you know, what's going to keep people from digging up nuclear waste 10,000 years from now. So I have the text of it. This is the wartime broadcasting service, is how it opens. This country has been attacked with nuclear weapons, communications have been severely disrupted, and the number of casualties and the extent of the damage are not yet known. Of course, they wouldn't be known when this guy said this, because this was pre-taped, because he's somewhere else. It continues. We shall bring you further information as soon as possible, which, since he's pre-recorded, means like never. Meanwhile, stay tuned to this wavelength, stay calm, and stay in your own homes. Remember, there is nothing to be gained by trying to get away. Okay? Very, very similar to the warnings about the nuclear waste 10,000 years hence. So please remember that, ladies and gentlemen. There's nothing to be gained by trying to get away. Hello, welcome to the show.
Of life without music, silence the whole day long, ears that don't hear rhythm, words without a song, just don't know what to do, how could I live out my day, would I be getting up, pushing my life away, when the drums come calling, the bass line pulls you in, sounds of regal splendor,
from the other side of the pond, from London, England, from Hammersmith, London. You've flown over it, if you've been in London. I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome to this edition of the show. Dear Mr. Shearer, I'm pleased to see that someone has begun to address the problems with over-the-air digital television. Coming your way soon, of course. I live only 14 miles from the major transmission towers of the Philadelphia area network broadcast. Nevertheless, during the past 3 years that I've been watching over-the-air digital transmissions, lucky you, I continue to encounter problems, especially with the local NBC affiliate. Well, that's a relief, because there's nothing. Digital signals are much more sensitive to interference from a variety of sources, like trees with leaves. Currently, I can bail out of a poor digital signal and watch the analog broadcast. I won't be able to do that after February 2009. And no one at the stations really cares that much about what people like me encounter. We're such a small part of the viewer audience. Without cable or satellite reception, we are, in effect, the Rodney Dangerfields of the TV audience. Ron in Philadelphia. Ron, I feel your pain. Ron, ladies and gentlemen, checking in with us. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Oh, a lot of them this week. Starting with Mike Gilbert, the former friend of O.J. Simpson, who helped O.J. hide oodles of valuable stuff. So the Goldmans couldn't get a hold of it because he owed them, you know, they would have had the right to seize it. That's part of their $33 million judgment against O.J. for, killing. On the Dr. Phil show, same Mike Gilbert appears and is confronted by Fred Goldman.
Anything that you have thought of me or that you currently think of me, I thought of myself. And I am sorry. I can try to do the right thing.
For all these years, you helped him squirrel away his money, hide assets, and I think you're full of crap that you are remorseful.
I just hope that one day, 10 years, 20 years from now, you understand that I am sorry.
He's sorry. Dr. Phil knows he's sorry, of course. Dr. Phil gets it. Or at least Dr. Phil gets the ratings. And then there's Jim Cramer.
I let you down because I wasn't skeptical enough. I have to presume when it comes to banking right now, there is no objective truth. Just negatives. Just terrible things. I let my judgment of steel cloud my thinking about Wachovia. Is he to blame? Did he take advantage of me? Perhaps yes. But ultimately, I must be a firewall for you, and this time I let the firewall down. Phil, I have no choice. I got to put my friend Bob Steele on the wall of shame. You know what? I should put myself in the annex. I didn't protect you good. I didn't protect you better. I screwed up. I apologize.
Jim Cramer, the money guy on CNBC who yells. He wasn't yelling because he's sorry. Judge Emmett Sullivan refused this week to dismiss the criminal case against Senator Ted Stevens, Republican of Alaska. We still don't know whether Sarah Palin thinks you should vote for him or not. He's on trial for corruption. The government had apparently violated its obligation to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense, but the judge says the defense now has the information and can still use it in the trial. Prosecutor Brenda Morris apologized profusely, not profanely, for failing to provide the material to Stevens earlier. She said it was a simple mistake, not an intentional attempt to undermine the defense. I'm standing here as humbly as I know how, Morris told the judge. That's some humble standing. Dateline Providence, Rhode Island, the owner of a plumbing supply store has apologized for asking customers who weren't speaking English for their social security numbers. Jose Genau complained to civil rights agencies earlier this year, alleging David Richardson asked to see his social security card. After hearing Janao, a U.S. citizen and a friend who's also a citizen, speak Spanish inside his store. The two had been trying to buy $18 worth of plumbing supplies. Janao said during the encounter, Richardson told the men that the majority of people who do not speak English in Rhode Island are illegals. In the apology made public this week, Richardson said he was trying to start a discussion about illegal immigration in Rhode Island. He agreed to donate $500 to charity. The producers behind the widely panned Fox sitcom Do Not Disturb took a new approach with critics. The show's production team sent a letter to a handful of TV critics admitting their first episode wasn't good. Attached was a DVD of another episode they thought was better. We here at Do Not Disturb agree that by airing the particular episode, we created much confusion and we deserve all the criticism. They apologized for being the perpetrators of such bad television. Nonetheless, Fox canceled the show. Yes, you can be too bad for Fox. Dateline, Arkansas City, Kansas. The mayor of a Kansas town has apologized for appearing in blackface. City Mayor Mel Kuhn. Good night, everybody. Met with NAACP officials this week to take full responsibility for his actions. His apology, posted on an NAACP website, says he's sincerely sorry for the offensive nature of his actions. Kuhn appeared in blackface as a part of a drag queen beauty contest. It just gets better. That raised money for an organization that helps foster children. He says he got the idea from the movies Norbit and Big Mama's House, which feature black men portraying black women. He told the newspaper, the Arkansas Traveler, that he really wasn't in blackface. He said he looked more like a gypsy. Touch 'em all, babe. That's what I say. Just touch 'em all. Dateline Ottawa, the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has responded with an apology to an international uproar over a column the broadcaster ran which insulted Sarah Palin. The CBC published the apology after receiving about 300 complaints, and that's Canada, involving the piece. The piece was entitled, "A Mighty Wind Blows Through the Republican Convention. Hey, we should sue. Chris, hello." Heather Malik wrote it. She wrote that Palin, with her toned-down version of the porn actress look, would give McCain the white trash vote. The CBC had previously refused to retract the column, signing fair comment, but now it's issued an official apology and retraction, admitting the article was a classic piece of political invective. It is viciously partisan, grossly hyperbolic, and intensely partisan. And besides, we got 300 complaints. Dateline Warsaw, Poland. Poland's last communist leader denied this week that he led an organized criminal group intent on depriving people of freedom when he opposed martial law back in 1981. Cracking down on the pro-democracy solidarity movement, General Wojtek Jaruzelski, 85 now, doesn't look a day, dismissed as unfounded the charges brought against him by the Institute of National Remembrance. Wish we had one of those. Not possible. It's a state body that investigates communist-era crimes. I often repeat the words, I regret, I deplore, I apologize, especially in relation to death, suffering, and pain caused during the crackdown, Jaruzelski told the four-judge panel. But that does not mean I plead guilty to charges as presented in the indictment. It's the first time Jaruzelski had a chance to speak at the trial, which opened September 12th. Well, that's one more time speaking at his trial, and O.J. took advantage of. The chief legislative aide to Philadelphia City Councilman W. Wilson Good issued a letter of apology. W. Wilson Good, Jr., issued a letter of apology this week for flashing handwritten signs in city council chambers that compared a local Fox TV news reporter to the Ku Klux Klan. In the letter, the aide to Good, Latrice Bryant, said, quote, "I apologize for my public, albeit silent, display of the handwritten signs. What I did was inappropriate and inexcusable." Bryant and Good are black. The reporter in question is white. A Federal Express worker has apologized for taking a television from a loading dock, thereby disappointing FedEx, and putting it in his vehicle. Where did this happen? Crestview. Yeah, that helps me know. Please don't name your communities Crestview if you want people to know where you live. Sarah Palin is apparently ready to make up and let bygones be bygones in her first TV interview since the debate Thursday night. By the way, she goofed up the name of the general, trying to impress us that she knew the name of the general that Senator Biden had referenced as saying that Afghanistan would not be helped by a surge. She said, "General McClellan didn't say that." No, of course he didn't. He's dead. He was a general during the Civil War. General McKiernan said that. But Joe Biden didn't correct her on what the general's name was. And Joe Biden apparently confused Hezbollah with Hamas. Like, who wouldn't? What seemed to have escaped most public notice was how bollocksed up the moderator, Gwen Ifill, was. By the time she asked that question about Achilles' heels, what's your Achilles' heel? That question came out as I thought there was an IV vodka drip coming to the moderator's table. But nobody else apparently felt that way. She was being attacked in the days leading up to the debate, as you may know, by conservative bloggers, because she's coming out with a book in January that has the name Obama in the title. Anyway, Sarah Palin told Fox News Channel she promises to be not being so annoyed and impatient with mainstream media. She has a degree in journalism. Did you know that? And I will make that commitment because I do understand that as how I speak to the American people in a position like this. I speak to you and through you, and that way the message is received by American people. Quoting, she has a degree in journalism. So I apologize for the response that I gave through that interview and a couple questions, referring to the Katie Couric interview. I'm going to try harder. So she apologized for being irritated with Katie. That's why her answers were like that. It wasn't what you thought. A report released this week found the Chinese version of the popular internet messaging program Skype. The Chinese are monitoring the text chats with sensitive keywords and storing them along with millions of personal user records on computers that are easily accessible by any person. Skype, owned by U.S. people, Americans we call them, apologized on Thursday amidst anger from home for apparently allowing the compromising of its core principles of total security and privacy to satisfy the demands of the Chinese censors. Skype says only messaging conversations where one or more people were using the Chinese software were affected. That's a relief. And finally, this from the Dallas Mavericks, Josh Howard. Hey, basketball season's right around the corner. I know that's not me. I love this country. If it weren't for this country, I wouldn't be out here playing basketball. For me to have that opportunity is the greatest. That's not me. That's not Josh Howard. That was an idiot. Howard was speaking to media members for the first time since his July rant at a charity event when the Star Spangled Banner was playing. He said he doesn't celebrate the song because he's black. The video of that eventually made it onto YouTube. And on the eve of training camp, he said he wished he could retract those words and that he looks forward to being able to show fans who've clamored for the Mavericks to get rid of him that he's not a bad guy. I apologize to everybody I offended, the 6'7 forward said. I'm upset with myself and the way I've acted. It was just me joking around. I just wasn't using my head. I learned that words really do hurt. I went to military school. I have friends that serve in the military. I know how it is to wake up and salute the flag. In the national anthem every game, I have my hand over my heart. It was just me not thinking. Do you like me now? No, he didn't say that, but that's Josh Howard trying real hard to save the old career in Dallas. Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, it may have escaped notice, what with all the brouhaha over the bailout and the debate and the thing, but Secretary of Defense Robert Gates this week said some interesting stuff, criticized the shock and awe strategy of the invasion of Iraq. The defense secretary did, because it's a new one. He said the Pentagon's narrow focus on conventional combat operations was costly when U.S. ground troops had to switch gears to stabilization and insurgency fighting. The Pentagon bureaucracy, he said, failed to respond quickly enough to the need for innovative counterinsurgency operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He called for reforms to make the Pentagon more agile and flexible. Yeah, that'll work. Adopt a policy. Have some rules about flexibility. We must be flexible. All right, that'll do it. He says the military struggle to adjust to the counterinsurgency mission in Iraq, quote, came at a frightful human, financial, and political cost. For every heroic and resourceful innovation by troops and commanders on the battlefield, there was some institutional shortcoming at the Pentagon they had to overcome. He says, be skeptical of systems analysis, computer models, game theories. Well, he could be talking to the guys on Wall Street, couldn't he? Officers should look askance at notions of conflict that imply adversaries can be cowed, shocked, or awed into submission, instead of being tracked down hilltop by hilltop, house by house. He said the Defense Department took too long to develop up-armored Humvees, mine-resistant vehicles, jammers, and other gear to counter roadside bombs. Why did we have to bypass existing institutions and procedures to get the capabilities we need to protect our troops? He asked. And one can just imagine that Donald Rumsfeld, wherever he is, had a two-word answer to that question. Stuff happens. And he will have that answer moments from now here on the show.
We know what we know. We think we know what we don't know. But if we don't know what we don't know,
the world is real.
Stuff happens. Our intel, it was bulletproof. We had the bullets, just not the proof. Our bullets, they proved what bullets prove. Stuff happens. Stuff happens. Looters got to loot. Stuff happens. Shooters shoot. It's all moot. Freedom can be untidy. For years, Iraq has been untidy. So why do you hate their freedom? Stuff happens. You fight with the army you have. Otherwise, you need another army. The army we had was the one we had. Stuff happens. The dead enders, they just refuse to die. They haven't thrown the final throws yet. We're in there until we leave. Stuff happens. Stuff happens. It happens every day. Stuff happens. If you're in the way, thank the USA. The unknowable, it can't be known. The unshowable just will not be shown. I rented this war I didn't own. Say it again, girls. Take me home now. Stuff happens.
This is Le Show from London. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Because I'm outside the bubble. The public should not expect a decisive military victory in Afghanistan. That's not me saying that. That's Britain's most senior military commander warning that, delivering that warning today. Brigadier General Mark Carleton Smith said the aim was to reduce the uprising to a level at which it could be managed by the Afghan army. Wasn't that what John Kerry said? He was derided for saying terror. Yeah. And he made clear this could involve talking to the Taliban. Hello, Taliban. We never talk to terrorists until the general says that's what you got to do. It's necessary, he says, to, quote, lower our expectations, unquote, and accept that it would be unrealistic to expect that multinational forces can entirely rid Afghanistan of armed groups. This story is all over the British media today. Brigadier Carlton Smith is commander of a brigade which has just completed its second tour of Afghanistan. He told the Sunday Times his forces had taken the sting out of the Taliban for 2008. But he added, "We're not going to win this war." These are our closest allies and friends, ladies and gentlemen, and they're so darn defeatist. It's about reducing it to a manageable level of insurgency that's not a strategic threat and can be managed by the Afghan army. We may well leave with there still being a low but steady ebb of rural insurgency. That's worth every penny. From the Independent in London, in theory, Britain now has 10 operating nuclear power stations. Government boasts they supply about one-fifth of the power that keeps the lights on. The reality, as a survey investigation by The Independent on Sunday shows, is very different. The majority of the power stations are in dire trouble. Their failure is leading to the most acute concern in years that the country may run short of electricity this winter. Two of the 10 have been idle for almost a year, both reactors out of action due to corrosion. Another two have had one of their reactors closed down for months, and yet another two are having to run both their reactors at less than three-quarters of their normal power for safety reasons. And remember, nothing can be achieved by trying to run away. And even that is not the end of it. Of the four that are still in good working condition, these are British nuclear plants, one is due to shut down permanently in 2 years' time, a second is partially closed for routine maintenance, a third is facing safety questions following the discovery of flaws in similar reactors in Japan. This is largely responsible for an alarming tightening of electricity supplies in Britain that's forecast to start at the beginning of November as it gets colder and darker. An independent nuclear analyst, John Large, that's the way they name people here, says it's all in a pretty sad state. The reactors are starting to break up. They're becoming knackered, British for tired. There comes a point when you simply have to turn the things off. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. There seems to be a pattern in the American government. Oh, well, that's just the train going by. Don't mind that. There seems to be a pattern in the American government. Some evidence came to light about that this week. First, from the Washington Post, the Defense Department will pay private U.S. contractors in Iraq up to $300 million over the next 3 years to produce news stories, entertainment programs, and public service advertisements, public service, for the Iraqi media in an effort to, quote, engage and inspire, unquote, the local population to support the United States objectives and the Iraqi government. The new contracts awarded last week to four companies will expand and consolidate what the United States military calls information/psychological operations in Iraq far into the future, even as whatever happens, happens. Iraq, where hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent on such contracts, has been the proving ground for the transformation to a counterinsurgency doctrine in which information control is considered key to success. Well, just bring in Clear Channel. The tools they're using, the means, the robustness of this activity has just skyrocketed since 2003, says a senior U.S. military official, one of several who discussed the sensitive defense program on condition of... The Pentagon still sometimes feels it's playing catch-up in a propaganda market dominated by Al-Qaeda. One official described how part of the program works. There's a video piece produced by a contractor showing a family being attacked by a group of bad guys. No, this is the Americans. And their daughter's being taken off. The message is, you've got to stand up against the enemy. The professionally produced vignette, he said, is offered for airing on various TV stations in Iraq. They don't know that the originator of the content is the U.S. government. If they did, they would never run anything. Does this sound familiar? Do you remember, ladies and gentlemen, about 2 years into the current administration when professionally produced videos were being supplied to television stations in this country and viewers didn't know that the material was being supplied by the U.S. government? If you ask most Iraqis, the defense official said, they would say the video came from the government. our own government. On the other hand, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, to deal with its image problem, for years being pummeled by Congress for poor inspections of tainted vegetables, drugs, and other products, decided to hire a contractor for a PR campaign that would create and foster a lasting positive public image of the agency for the American public. It was a competition. No, there wasn't. There's a policy for a competition, but it wasn't held to get the lowest bid. The FDA officials came up with a plan to ensure the work would go to a Washington PR firm with links to the FDA official arranging the deal, according to the Washington Post. The plan used a clever route around the standard procedure. The contract was given to a firm owned by a native Alaska corporation. You betcha! It does not have to compete for federal work because it qualifies for special set-asides. And then that corporation would hand over the whole job to a Washington firm called Corvus, with a Q, Communications. The FDA deputy commissioner, made aware of the findings by the newspaper, said this week he had suspended the contract and ordered an independent investigation. But the government giveth, the government taketh away. The Yucca Mountain Information Center, an information center devoted to telling you how cool it's going to be when there's a place to dump our nuclear waste, has closed due to budget cuts. Closure came only 2 years and 2 months after the 50,000-square-foot building opened in July 2006. There were originally three information offices, Las Vegas, Beatty, Nevada, and Pahrump. The Pahrump Center was the last to close. The Department of Energy will continue to pay the annual lease, $130,000 for the building, but there won't be an employee on hand to explain the exhibits. Speaking of Yucca Mountain, there is a 1 in 125 risk, person risk, of a cancer developing if you live near Yucca Mountain. They've quantified it now. So that's reassuring. Tell me you agree.
Of it, don't want to miss the dance, but that unrelenting rhetoric just leaves you in a trance. They say that life's a lesson, how come everybody's guessing? Waiting at the station, wondering if there'll be a train, knowing that it's you, not them, that has to take the strain. The water from your well is dry and you can't get a taste. The sands of time run out with what seems like indecent haste. Adversity a blessing, sounds to me like window dressing. Then you can do.
The captains and their crews complain about the ATC. It's not their fault, of course. We have to blame the powers that be. Continually distressing, all this calculated guessing. Try to stay afloat. Sometimes it gets too hot, but you're afraid to miss the boat. Now don't you fret and don't you cry, no point in keeping score. 'Cause you can bet that when you die, they'll come and raid the store. Let them know that you're not messing, and be sure to keep them guessing. Won't leave anybody guessing.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the discussions of the bailout, one story I think kind of fell off the radar screen, as I heard somebody say recently. It was the right before the House voted this past Monday on the bailout and rejected it. It was Vice President Cheney traveling to Capitol Hill to try to silence the chorus of Republican House members complaining about the $700 billion plan. But the House Republicans who walked into the closed-door meeting with Cheney walked out angrier than they were when they walked in. They described what happened in between as both a bloodbath and an unmitigated disaster. One Republican congressman said he had confronted Cheney respectfully, a level of dissent Republicans once considered heresy in the Bush administration. Another lawmaker present said that Cheney and White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolten were in worse shape when they left than when they came in. A dramatic turnaround in the relationship between Dick Cheney and members of Congress. To find out more, I think we have to drill deep.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of a man who's just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney, confidential. Hank Kissinger once said, power is an aphrodisiac. I beg to differ. Power is just the way real men get their rocks off. While a night in the hay with a hot Vegas tripper might float the boat of some nickel-dime congressman from East Bumpuck, big boys get their jollies from making sure idiot laws get waylaid on the road to enforcement, or getting opinions written that say whatever you want to do is legal, basically because you want to do it. Even just describing the exercise of power is getting me hot. So, when we started on this whole bill to bail out our friends in the financial sector, my only question was, Why go to Congress in the first place? Just give Hank Paulson the checkbook and make sure the canceled checks come straight to me. But Hank looked at that $700 billion signing pen as if it was going to give him what we used to call a social disease. Two Thursdays ago, 11:17 a.m.
It's not that I think it's important at a time like this to insist on the niceties, Dick.
It's never a good time to do that, Hank.
No, of course it isn't.
Niceties are for wusses.
Yes, and Democrats.
I'm a busy man. Don't be redundant.
All right, sorry. It's just that I can't help thinking somebody in Congress is going to bring up the whole power of the purse stuff, and we'll end up having to run this by them anyway.
You know, that crap wasn't interesting to me even in civics class. Where I sit right now, it's more pointless than a photo safari. We made that mistake once before, letting Congress and their fellow bedwetters at the UN almost shut down our Iraq account. I think my constituent-in-chief has profited from that particular experience, learning-wise.
All right, but time really is of the essence, Mr. Vice President.
I know it is. So call me Dick.
All right, Dick. So, a wrangle over what some legislators are certain to claim is, shall we say, an extra-constitutional process will just waste some very, very precious days or even weeks.
Mm-hmm. You think the framers of the Constitution ever anticipated a crisis involving collateralized debt obligations?
Hell, Dick, even I didn't, and I helped make them up.
All right, then. Let's finally take the training wheels off this executive branch, Hank. No better time than with you in the saddle. Don't make me break this vase.
Look, I get it that it's beneath the man of your stature, or the president's for that matter, to have to play some version of Mother May I before taking action.
It's frustrating.
And humiliating.
Mainly frustrating, believe me.
Fine. But why don't we craft something that we can take to Congress that explicitly writes them out of the picture once they approve it?
You mean a bill saying that they have no power of oversight over you?
Something like that. You know the lingo better than
I. Hell, why not exclude the courts while we're at it?
I'd be okay with that.
Oh, you'd be more than okay once you think of the pile of legal bills you might otherwise incur. Ask Scoot or Libby about that sometime when you feel like slumming.
I'll do that. So?
Well, if I can't sell that idea to the Congress, Hank, I ought to put away my shingle, quit this racket, and just go back to having heart attacks for a living.
So, we have an understanding, Dick?
The secure and disclosed one, Hank. The very best kind. What is it they say about the best laid plans? Hell, in today's Washington, even plans can't get laid. By the time I went down to Capitol Hill this week to brief my fellow Republicans on the little program Hank and I had decided upon, somebody had told the inmates they had the keys to the asylum. Not to put too fine a point on it, I got rolled worse than a drunk John in a Shanghai whorehouse. So let's say when I got back to the secure undisclosed and met with my secure undisclosed legal advisor, Dave Addington, I wasn't in the mood for niceties. Tuesday, 3:17 p.m.
That was my crystal gavel from the Federalist Society.
Yeah, you think I give a damn? Dave, you didn't see my House Republican colleagues. They looked at me with an expression of contempt I haven't seen since Don Rumsfeld heard the president wanted his resignation. I mean, damn! House Republicans. I was one of them. Mm-hmm. You think we could have staged some kind of banana republic uprising against a vice president of our own party who, out of the goodness of his heart, came all the way down to the Hill to give him the simple courtesy of a goddamn briefing? Not even borderline plausible.
No.
And that was in the time of the old underpowered vice presidency.
Mm-hmm. That was the Chalice of Freedom from the Heritage Foundation.
They crank him out by the gross in China. I'll get you one. But I hope I'm getting your attention.
No, Dick, you've got that. Mm-hmm. What do you need me to do?
Dave, I've come to rely upon you for a certain kind of profound legal sorcery.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'm not finished. You're the guy that squeezed an opinion out of the Justice Department that said that we could enhance our interrogations until the cows came home bleeding from their wounds.
Oh, guilty as charged, sir.
You're the guy who kept state out of Iraq, who kept justice out of military tribunals, who damn near kept the president out of his administration. You're the guy.
Only doing my job, Mr. Vice President.
Aren't you going to tell me what that last thing I broke was?
Oh, it was just my honorary doctorate from Liberty University. Look, Dick, I know who I am. What is it you need?
Article 1 of the Constitution, okay?
The one that establishes Congress, right.
Isn't it possible to craft a legal opinion that says, when they wrote Article 2, creating the executive branch, that very fact implied abolition of the legislature? The Congress was only a temporary stopgap institution until the executive branch had been stood up.
You want to abolish Congress?
I just want a novel analysis based upon the idea that Congress is itself an unconstitutional usurpation of executive power. Not that we'd actually try to implement it, of course. Just a little something to rattle our cage.
Well, I don't know, Dick. All of our best attorneys, the ones we placed all over the government, have left public service now.
I know, but couldn't we kind of bring a few of them in freelance to...
I don't think their lawyers would let them.
Really?
No, absolutely. They've all gotten lawyered up.
And they wouldn't on a pro bono, secure, undisclosed basis?
All I know is everybody turned me down when I went for some help in drafting that emergency election suspension order you asked for.
Oh, crap. Sorry. I know those were wedding pictures.
Oh, hey, Dick, no problem. I'm feeling fortunate.
Really? Why?
I'm just thanking God we didn't have this little conversation during a hunting trip.
Hey, they can have their legislation and their elections. We've got another 4 months to finish our work on the unitary executive. I'm liking our odds. End a partial diary for the beginning of October 2008. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney, confidential, 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 confidential.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
All right, Glenn, we have to get on with it. The number of polluted dead zones in the world's oceans is rising fast, and coastal fish stocks are more vulnerable to collapse than previously feared, scientists said this week. The spread of dead zones, areas of oxygen-starved water, is emerging as a major threat to coastal ecosystems globally. This is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Marine organisms are more vulnerable to low oxygen content than currently recognized, with fish and crustaceans being the most vulnerable. They're also good eating. The number of reported low oxygen zones is growing globally at a rate of 5% a year, said one of the researchers. The number has risen from almost none in the late 1970s to almost more than 140 in 2004. Higher temperatures tied to global warming, blamed by the UN on human use of fossil fuels, may aggravate the problem of dead zones, partially because oxygen dissolves less readily in warmer water. I didn't know that. See? You learn something every few weeks. And apples and sweet corn, brook trout and smallmouth bass, fall foliage and winter snow cover will all disappear from Pennsylvania if global warming continues at current rates, according to a detailed state-specific climate change report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. The report says if emissions of carbon dioxide are not significantly reduced, the state's climate by the end of the century will closely resemble Alabama and Georgia, and the accent will surely follow. Arctic ice extent during the 2000 melt season, not smelt, melt, dropped to the second lowest level since satellite measurements began in 1979. Reaching the lowest point in its annual cycle of melt and growth on September 14th. Preliminary data also indicate 2008 may represent the lowest volume of Arctic sea ice on record. According to the researchers, it's due to rising concentrations of greenhouse gases that have elevated temperatures across the Arctic and the presence of and the strong natural variability in Arctic sea ice, according to the scientists involved. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, it is, as usual, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of the show from London. The program returns next week at the same time on the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. This Yusen 440 cable system in Japan. Around the world through the facilities... Around the world through the facilities of American Forces Radio. Up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. On Sirius and XM satellite radio, try to tell them apart. Around the world via the internet, on your computer. Two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/show, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Maybe I'm getting the Gwen Ifill's vodka IV, and it would be just like trying to figure out this bailout, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you really? All righty. Thank you very much. Just one more week to see the silent echo chamber, my little video art thing at the Susan Inglett Gallery, if you happen to be in Manhattan, New York City. Something to while away a spare minute. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist for this program are both available at the always evolving harryshearer.com. And yes, the Donald Rumsfeld song is from Songs of the Bushmen. It is a great gift idea. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks, and to Steve Wyatt here in Hammersmith, West London, for helping to make today's program possible. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show it comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London Town.